This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is musician, songwriter, and singer Polly Jean Harvey, who's also known as PJ Harvey. She was named Rolling Stone's Best New Artist in 1992 and Artist of the Year in 1995. In 2001, her band won England's top music award, the Mercury Prize. She's just released her 8th album called Let England Shake. Harvey has said that she dislikes repeating herself, and this album takes her in a new direction. She's written many songs about love and obsession. Let England Shake features her new songs about war and about her country, England. Musically, she's drawn on folk ballads and rock in ways similar to Nick Cave, who she's collaborated with, and Richard Thompson. Before we talk, let's start with a song from Let England Shake. This is The Words That Maketh Murder. Harvey is featured on auto harp and saxophone, as well as vocals. That's PJ Harvey from her new album, Let England Shake. Polly Jean Harvey, welcome to Fresh Air. I really like this album. It's a pleasure to have you here. There's an image in the song that we just heard of arms and legs in the trees. And I wonder what inspired that image, if you'd seen a photo like that or if somebody had described it in something that you'd read or somebody who had witnessed war described that to you.
Well, I did an enormous amount of research for this album. I needed to. And the more research that I did, it would keep leading me into different areas. There seemed to be so much to uncover. And much of the most valuable research that I did came from first-hand accounts, from the eyewitness, from the person on the ground, whether that person was a soldier, and regardless of either side of what was the action that was taking place, or whether it was a civilian, again, on either side. It was those first-hand accounts that I drew upon most.
You have a big range in your singing voice. Some of your songs are really deep. Some of them, by deep I mean in a low range, and some of them are in a high range. And some of the songs on your new album are in a high range, and I think that that's kind of interesting because it's a more female, you know, a range that is more associated with women than men, but you're singing about men in war in a more female kind of voice than some of your other recordings. I don't know if that's making any sense to you. But some of your recordings are really in a very deep voice, but this one. Yeah.
It makes perfect sense what you're describing. With each body of work, with each album, with each song, actually, one has to find the right voice with which to deliver the song at its best. Now, with this new record, it was very, very difficult to find what voice to deliver such words with, because obviously these words have a great deal of weight. They have very strong narratives. They're very much action on the ground, storytelling, the witness to the action on the ground. I needed to find a voice that didn't add more weight to the weight that was already there. And it took a lot of experimentation to find the voice. To begin with, I tried approaching singing it with what I would call my full voice, which is a 41-year-old adult woman voice. And it destroyed the words. It was far too strong, much too weighty, because the words already had that. So gradually, through a process of elimination and mistakes, I finally came across the voice that you're hearing, which you're rightly describing as a very high, very simple voice. I was looking for something that was almost characterless, that could just be the narrator of the story, almost disembodied from the action, just relaying what they can see happening. And that voice had to be very, very simple, very pure, very high, very to inhabit almost a characterless place within the scene.
It sounds almost like you approach this album as music theatre.
Well, I often see the songs as I'm writing them in the way that you might see a specific scene in a film. I can often see the action and see the colours, and I can focus on that as I'm writing the song, and then it brings to me all of the descriptive words and language that I need.
My guest is PJ Harvey, and she has a new album called Let England Shake, and it's war songs, songs that come out of different wars, songs she wrote about different wars. And I want to play another song. It's called All and Everyone. And if you don't mind, I'm going to just say the first few words of the lyrics of the song. Death was everywhere, in the air and in the sounds, coming off the mounds of Bolton's Ridge. Tell us a little bit about this song and the battle that you're writing about.
Well, I would like to interject and just say that the album is not solely about war. There are other songs on this record that are much more to do with one's nation. And although as an English woman I sing about England, I tried to use words that were dealing with the emotional quality that any human being could recognise in the way that they felt about their country as well. So it's to do with the world we live in. That world, as you know, is a brutal one and full of war. It's also full of many wonderful things and love and hope. And I tried to offset the brutal language with very beautiful music all the way through, but also bringing love in the form of relationships between the people in the songs. And that was equally as important to me. Of course, there are songs specifically referencing war in very brutal language, because that's a huge part of our world today. I found that in order to make more sense of our contemporary wars, I had to learn quite a lot about history, because it all gets passed down the line. It has repercussions. It's in collective memory in all of our different countries, of all of the wars that have gone on there before. And so I looked a lot back through the ages, and one of the conflicts that affected me a great deal was the Gallipoli campaign in the First World War. Something about the dreadful mismanagement and the shocking waste, needless waste, I thought about a lot and really affected me. Because to me, it had such resonance with the wars that are going on today. The basic language that human beings use to describe the emotions that go with such conflicts don't change. Those words are the same when human beings are just trying to describe what it's like. And that's what drew me in. And then in some ways, the record is timeless. It doesn't matter what war it was, the language of war is the same.
Well, let's hear Polly Jean Harvey's song All and Everyone from the new PJ Harvey album, Let England Shake.
Death was everywhere, in the air and in the sounds, coming off the mounds of Bolton's Ridge. It was in the laughter and drinking water. It approached the beach, the strings of cutters dropped in the sea. May you
hearts that threatened to pump their boxes as we advanced into the sun.
That's All and Everyone from PJ Harvey's new album, Let England Shake. So the song we just heard is about how death was everywhere after this battle. And I know your mother is or was a sculptor, your father a stonemason. Correct me if I have that wrong. Is it right that one of them made tombstones?
Well, my father and mother have most of their lives quarried stone. There's a specific quarry in Somerset in England called Ham Hill, and this quarry range has a very particular type of stone, and there's only two different people that quarry this. And it goes throughout the world. It goes to many different countries because it's a unique stone. They've quarried this particular stone for the last 40 years, I think. So they work in that together, and quarrying stone, you know, that's a manner of actually hacking it out of the ground. You know, enormous quarry faces and huge blocks of stone come out of there, and out of that, the stone is broken down for housing, paving, house names, tombstones, fireplaces, and there are many different workers at all different levels. Some of them are cutting the huge blocks out of the ground, and others are slicing down the stone, and others are engraving, letter cutting into it. My mum does a lot of letter cutting. She also does more sculptural pieces. Often people want something carved into a headstone or into a fireplace, which can be quite detailed.
Now, you grew up on a farm, didn't you?
I grew up on a small holding. I wouldn't say it was a farm because my dad's primary occupation is stone quarrying. Mm-hmm. But we did have animals, and we lived off our animals, and my mother and father still do.
What kind of animals?
Sheep, cattle, chickens.
Oh, wow. So you grew
ducks.
Up in a pretty rural place in
yes.
England.
Yes, yeah.
So how were you exposed to music? What was in your parents' record collection? I imagine you weren't going to a lot of concerts growing up in rural England with a lot of animals.
No, quite the opposite. I was going to concerts all the time.
Seriously?
Yes, because my mother and father are very involved with music. It's completely part of their soul. And they have an incredible record collection, all vinyl, of some of the best artists, in my eyes, that you can come across. I mean, people like Howling Wolf, Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, John Lee Hooker, Nina Simone, Captain Beefheart. All of these artists were what I grew up listening to every day of my life. And there's a very healthy music scene in the West Country of England where I grew up. Many people, not just my mother and father, were involved in bringing a lot of bands to play in our local areas. And often there would be bands staying at my house. Every weekend there was live music to go and see.
No kidding.
I grew up.
Really? Who stayed at your house?
Many different bands from the London era in the early 80s. A lot of rhythm and blues bands, Juice on the Loose, Diz and the Doormen, bands that you wouldn't be familiar with, but at that time were big on the scene. And bands like Rocket 88, which was Ian Stewart's jazz formation, Ian Stewart being often termed as the sixth Rolling Stone. But he was a great friend of my mum and dad's, and he had some wonderful bands. Rocket 88 was one, of which Charlie Watts played in quite often. And they would stay at our house as well.
So when you were listening to, for instance, Howlin' Wolf, the great blues singer, he's from another era. He's from another country. And, you know, African-American music. What did you relate to about his music as a young girl growing up in rural England?
Well, it's very hard to put into words, and this is where I constantly struggle trying to describe music in words, but the best I could do is to say the soul, the spirit of it, touched my soul and spirit in a way that I felt understood and understood it. And I can't describe it better than that.
I thought I'd play a recording of yours from 1995, a great recording called To Bring You My Love. And I feel like I hear Helen Wolfe and other blues singers in this. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right.
Good. I'm so glad you think that. Okay, so we should hear it. Do you want to say anything about singing this? This voice is so different than the one we've been hearing from your new album. It's a real, like, guttural voice. It sounds like you've met the devil.
Well, again, like I said earlier in the interview, for each song, I take that song individually and I look at what is the best way for me to deliver this song to its maximum strength. And that was the voice that I uncovered that this song needed to be delivered with.
Okay, so this is PJ Harvey in 1995, To Bring You My Love.
I was born in the desert. I've been down for years. Jesus, come closer. I think my time is near. And I've traveled over dry earth and floods, hell and high water, to bring you my love. Climbed over mountains, travel the sea, cast down
PJ Harvey recorded in 1995. She has a new album called Let England Shake. So we were talking about how you grew up in a house not only with sheep and cattle, but surrounded by music. Musicians stayed at your home. Your parents helped bring the musicians to town to perform. They had a great vinyl record collection. When did you know that you wanted to be a musician, that you wanted to perform?
There wasn't really a point that I can recall. I was a visual artist primarily and a writer. Even from a very young age, I wrote a lot of stories and poetry. And likewise, I had a desire to create always with painting and drawing, and I still do that daily. And I always had a desire to show my work. I'd want to read the stories that I'd written. I'd want to show the drawings that I'd made. That was just purely natural. And so I knew that I wanted to go into the arts in some way and that I would like to show that work in some way. That's all I knew. I didn't know what territory specifically it would be in, whether I'd be writing or acting or singing or drawing. And as I grew a bit older, I actually was prepared to go into fine art school and do a degree. And I had my place. I was going to go and do that. So that was what I was actually settled upon when I was first offered a record deal, because I'd put together a band at art college and we'd just begun to play in London. And I think it was maybe our fourth or fifth gig ever. And I was offered a record deal, and I mean, that's what happened. That's just the way that life took me.
I want to play an early song of yours, and this is Rid of Me. And would you say a few words, if you remember, about writing this?
That time of writing the whole body of work that became Rid of Me, it was my second album. It was the first time of writing that I knew what I was writing would be heard. And so I for a long time felt quite crippled by fear and unable to write. And gradually worked through that and just remained true to myself and my instinct. And therefore you have a record that is very difficult record. It's not easy to listen to. It's certainly not what would get played very much on radio. And probably not what my record company was looking for at all at the time. But that's a case in point. It's what I needed to make. And that's all I had to stick by. I had to stick by what I needed to create as an artist, no matter how that came out.
Well, Rid of Me is actually really catchy. And in this song, you alternate. You know, we've been talking about the different voices that you use. You alternate between a higher voice and a lower voice in this.
Yes, yeah, again, all to do with the song and the dramatic effect that you can achieve.
Okay, so here's Polly Jean Harvey from 1993, I think this is?
Sound I right? think it is.
Okay.
I think so.
Okay, and this is Rid of Me. That was PJ Harvey, the title track of her album Rid of Me from 1993. She has a new album called Let England Shake. You recorded the new album in a 19th century church on a cliff overlooking the sea. Why did you choose to record the album in a church as opposed to a London recording studio?
It was the way things fell, because initially I was looking at recording in Berlin and I looked at studios there. I couldn't find a studio that I liked the feel of. So I came back to England not really knowing where I was going to record. And a man who lives locally and runs this church as an art space, it's primarily used for exhibitions of paintings and classical work. It's not really a functioning church as such anymore. He approached me and said if I ever needed somewhere to rehearse, the church was available, and that's how it happened.
What felt right about it?
The location was beautiful and weather-beaten and full of space and air and energy, and the building itself was high ceilings and stone walls and full of possibilities for recording sound. And I went there with Flood, my producer, and I sang a bit in the church for him to listen to, and we instantly knew it was the place to do the record.
Did it help, too, that it was a 19th century building, that it was old?
Well, I think it added to its beauty and spaciousness, and it just felt good in there. And that's all I ever look for. And sometimes a recording studio can feel good. I'm sitting here in Maida Vale in London speaking to you. This studio has always felt good to me. Every time I've come in here over the years, I like it here. Now, that doesn't go for any studio. And I might have walked into a different church and not like that church. So it's really hard to say why. But this church felt good.
I want to close with another song from your new album, Let England Shake. How about The Glorious Land? Would you say something to introduce it?
Well, again, I think too much is made of this being an album about England and war. You know, it's not as simple as that. It's about the world we live in. And this song, The Glorious Land, illustrates that rather well, I think, because it's non-specific, particularly. It's not... It could be anywhere that I'm singing from. And even the songs that refer to England or Glorious Land referring to America, it's the emotion behind, it's the call, it's the person, it's the individual, who we are, that is the voice here. And I tried to use throughout the record language that carried a certain ambiguity, a certain ambivalence, and I tried to remain impartial in some ways, in the way that any news correspondent might try and remain impartial. I just wanted to deliver the action. Here's the action. This is the story. This is what's going on the ground. And people make up their own minds about things.
After doing an album like Let England Shake, which is about feelings about country and war and lost friends, and where do you go from there? Do you know?
Well, what I've always done is just follow my instincts. And at some point, my instincts as a writer will take me into another area that I feel is strong enough that I want to concentrate on for a while. And at the moment, being a writer that writes every day, I'm in that familiar territory for me after one body of work has just been completed, that I'm feeling around. It's like feeling around in the dark, and I'll write something here and I'll write something there, and I'll think, that's not really it. Nope, that's not it. That's not it. And then after a period of time, you have to work through that time, and it's a very uncomfortable time to be in as a writer, because it's not nice to not know exactly where you're heading, what your focus is. Eventually, the focus comes, and then you just honour that, and that's the period that I'm in at the moment.
PJ Harvey, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was The Glorious Land from PJ Harvey's new album, Let England Shake. Today only, you can hear the entire album on our website, freshair.npr.org. Harvey will give a few performances in the U.S. in April, including at the Coachella Festival and a second show at New York City's Terminal 5, which was added because the first sold out so quickly. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with jazz pianist and composer George Shearing. He died Monday at the age of 91. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist George Shearing died yesterday at the age of 91. We're going to listen back to an interview with him. He was born in London and was blind from birth. He studied classical music, but was most inspired by the records of jazz pianists like Art Tatum, Fats Waller, and Teddy Wilson. In the 1940s, Shearing was one of England's most popular jazz musicians, but after World War II, he decided to move to New York, the center of modern jazz. He became an American citizen in 1956, the decade in which he enjoyed his greatest commercial success, leading the George Shearing Quintet. It featured the distinctive instrumentation of piano, guitar, and vibraphone. Shearing's best-known composition is Lullaby of Birdland. The solo piano recording we're listening to now of Jerome Kern's Yesterdays was recorded in 1974. When I spoke with George Shearing in 1986, he told me that as a child he studied piano at a school for the blind. I asked him if his teachers were confident that a blind person could master the piano.
I don't think it's a question of whether a blind child could master the piano as whether a blind child can make a living in anything other than playing in the pubs, which is where I started. You've got to remember one thing, Terry, and that is that if I chose, say, to be a studio musician, it's obviously necessary to read music. And yes, I can read Braille music, but that's not sight reading sighted music. You might find 30 pages of manuscript paper with so many notes on it, just as if, you know, flies were all over it. And we always say that there are some sighted people who read so well that if a fly appeared on the paper, they'd read it, you know. This is not available to the blind. But playing in the pub was, and eventually getting my own group was. And from there I went with an all-blind band, 15 blind guys learning to play instruments from being basket makers and chair caners. We were playing arrangements of Jimmy Lunsford and Duke Ellington and people like that.
How did you find each other? Who organized the band?
The National Institution for the Blind. People used to write all the parts out in Braille. I was the only one who didn't read his part. I could pick it up by ear because I learned a lot of the records as well. There were a couple of people in that band, the first trumpet player and the drummer, who had everything from early Miff Mole and stuff like that, all the way through Teddy Wilson and Tatum and Fats Waller. And these people all kind of became my mentors, as you can imagine. So it was that was a really wonderful training ground.
Just as you were really coming of age and, well, you'd already started your recording career, the war came along. How was the music scene in London changed by the war? And was there any place to perform or even places to listen during the war?
I had more work than I could handle because there were so many people called up. I would be doing studio work in the daytime because there was enough of it that didn't demand reading, and they couldn't afford to be that fussy any longer. So I learned the charts and did the recordings and the jazz broadcasts and whatever was involved. I did theater, two shows in theater, 8 and 10 at night. I went on to a supper club and played from 10:30 until about 1:30, and then on to a nightclub and played till 4, and then back in the studios the next morning at 10. I had much more work than I could handle.
Were you ever bombed while you were performing during the war?
Oh, yes. First of all, my mother was bombed out 3 times. And I was in a cab one night going to work, and we stopped at a traffic light. We heard this tremendous blast, and the cab shook like mad. And I said, boy, that was a close one, wasn't it? And there was no answer. And I said, that was a close one, wasn't it? And I put my hand in front, and the driver's gone. He ducked in a doorway, and when it was all clear, he came out again. I said, thanks a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Didn't you also do some playing inside air raid shelters during the
war? Oh, yes.
What kind of setup was that there'd be a piano there?
I met my first wife in an air raid shelter. And what we did, we played in the basement, which had been turned into a gymnasium. And there were kind of forms, you know, benches that one could sleep on or on the floor, and there were blankets and stuff. And there would be an upright piano there. So I was living with a song plugger at the time, and he and I would play four hands, much to the amusement of people that went, you know, down in that particular air raid shelter.
So you think it helped pass the time for everybody?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, sure. I mean, you had to make a life. I mean, you had no alternative. 15 hours a day, the raid would be on. Day and night, until we defeated the day raiders.
Well, after the war, you decided, I guess, not to stay in London, and you wanted to at least make a few trips to the United States. What was the lure of America for you?
I met a few American musicians just before and a few more during the war. And all as if they were in one voice, pretty well said, man, you should go over to the States. You kill them over there. Well, I started playing as an intermission pianist in 1948. What fun that was. My goodness. I'll never forget when I first sat in with Charlie Parker. Being a reserved Englishman, I should have said, what would you like to play, Mr. Parker? But I was a 28-year-old hippie who came from England. I never dressed like a hippie in my life. That's not the point. But the point is, I did say to him, what do you want to blow, Bird? And he thought, you know, he was a gentleman. He wasn't destructive. But I guess he felt it was necessary to put me through the paces and kind of just take me down a peg in case I became too cocky. And as I'm sure he didn't think in this, other than to be good schooling for me. So when I said, what do you want to play, Bird? He said, oh, how about all the things you are in five sharps? I don't know whether you play any piano, Terry, but that's a difficult piece of music to play in B major. I did it. I had the background, and I did it. And it was passing a few of these tests and winning favor with the American musicians by ability, which stood me in good stead.
We're listening to a 1986 interview with jazz pianist George Shearing. He died yesterday at the age of 91. Here's one of his most popular recordings, September in the Rain, recorded in 1949, featuring the George Shearing Quintet. In pop directions in a lot of its records. What was your reason for choosing that?
Capitol Records wanted it. They wanted me to add strings and add this and add that. And there were a number of very successful records because of that. But we started to lose favor with the critics, as you can imagine. And in retrospect, the critics were right because there was a lot less creativity involved in the more commercial side of my music.
Is it why you broke up the quintet?
I just got tired of it. It was on automatic pilot. I could go to sleep playing the show. And I tried several things. I surrounded it with brass. I surrounded it with Latin sounds. And people loved that. But I could work all day long on a fugue or a very intricate piece of music. When I came to work, we play Roses of Picardy, play I Remember April. You could work all day long. This is what they wanted. And I'm glad they wanted it, but it's tiresome. And it's confining. It's as if you have fetters around your neck. You just can't move, you know. And so I finally wanted to address myself to the proposition of being a complete pianist rather than a band leader who rests on his laurels until he gets tired enough to go to sleep.
It seems to me that in the last few years, you've been adding more and more popular song to your repertoire, playing with singers like Mel Torme, singing yourself. You've recently, I think it's recently, began singing.
Yeah, within the last 10 or 15 years, you know, recently, by comparison with my career. This is my 50th year in show business.
What attracts you to a song when
Lyrics. And how the lyrics fit with the music. You know, and being able to make literary sense out of the song. For instance, everybody, and I do mean everybody that I've heard, when they do Send in the Clowns, they sing, "Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career." Now, would you say it that way? Losing my timing this late in my career? You would say, "Losing my timing this late in my career," wouldn't you? But it's partly Sondheim's fault. I love him. I love him dearly. We had a long talk one night in the Carlisle about Bach. He's a great Bach enthusiast. But people have to use a little bit of imagination, a little bit of ingenuity. "Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career." This is why I love songs.
I see what you mean with that. Did Sondheim agree with you?
I think so. In fact, I know he did. Yes. Yes, he agreed with me completely.
You've written songs as well, and I think your best known piece is Lullaby of Birdland. Can you tell us the story behind writing that?
Birdland needed a theme song for a six-hour disc jockey show that they had in the early 50s.
And Birdland was a club in New York in the 50s?
Right. Yes.
Mostly bop musicians play
it. Right, yeah. Well, it was named for Charlie Parker, see, whose nickname was Bird. So I wrote this thing. I heard it in my head. I wrote it in 10 minutes. I always say 10 minutes and 35 years in the business. Over a steak in my dining room when I lived in New Jersey. I went back to that same butcher 1,000 times trying to get that same steak again. So they liked it, and they played it every hour on the hour, which is, of course, why it became my best-known song, because it's my only well-known song. When I go on as a composer, I said, "I'd like to play you a medley of my hit." You know, but the thing is that when something is hammered through people's heads, like, of course it's gonna, if it's got any substance at all that people can hang on to, of course it's gonna become a hit, you know. And that's what happened with Lullaby, and of course we got over 100 people recording it.
I don't know if you wrote it with a lyric in mind or not, but
no.
I have heard it sung.
Yes.
And the first line is, I'm not going to sing it. Maybe you'll do it. But they sing the first line with "Lullaby of Birdland" in it.
Yes, they do.
Do you want to just sing the line just to?
Yeah. Well, if you read it and you read it as if you're dividing the lines, he's, "Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel." Well, doesn't mean anything, does it, really? So, "Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel." Now, it means something because it's being read.
George Shearing, recorded in 1986. He died yesterday at the age of 91. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.